I'm sure with Paula and Bill's activism in this church, as well as maybe some of the rest of you, on racial justice and criminal justice, that you know who Bryan Stevenson is. He's a phenomenal person, and he wrote the book Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. He was the energy and moving force for this new museum in Montgomery to discover the names of all the people who were lynched in the South, African Americans who were lynched in the South, that they could, and memorialize them there. So this is from his book, Just Mercy. Simply punishing the broken, walking away from them, or hiding them from sight, only ensures that they remain broken, and we do too. There is no wholeness outside of our reciprocal humanity. They did it. The four young black men, aged 18 to 21, were caught on videotape, which aired on the news numerous times in the first week or so after the attack. One of them even turned himself into the police the next day. They were all involved, but not equally culpable. So the racially motivated problem that has occurred all too often in the U.S. of young black men being wrongly accused and arrested was not an issue or the issue in this case. And with the victims are two white men who work on staff for the UUA in Boston. UUA is our Unitarian Universalist Association, for anyone who's visiting. That's our national organization of congregations. The victims were brutally attacked during the UUA's General Assembly in New Orleans last summer. This presented us, the big us, that's the UUA and all UUs around the country and the world, and the small us, local UUs in New Orleans, with an opportunity, up close and personal, to respond as a community of faith based on our deeply held values of respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And for us, more recently at the First UU Church of New Orleans, our commitment to the Black Lives Matter movement. All of this brought us to the point to engage in a struggle for justice and healing for the victims, for the offenders, and the community. Specifically, a struggle for restorative justice, an approach which provides an alternative to incarceration and long prison sentences for the offenders, as it aims to repair and provide healing for the victims and everyone else involved. Good morning, friends. I bring you greetings from the First UU Church of New Orleans, where I'm a member, Community Church UU, North Shore UU Society, and the Center for Ethical Living and Social Justice Renewal. We're all in the greater New Orleans area, and we're the four entities on the ground who have been doing the work for restorative justice in this case. I want to share with you more than I can possibly do today, so I'm going to try to keep our time, stay on time, but I have too much to say. I want to share with you our understanding of what restorative justice or restorative justice approach means, a little about the process, who the key players and allies are, how important relationships or to doing this work, with a brief glimpse into our collective journey and a little of my own reflections. I want to tell you about the current status of our efforts and where we hope to go from here. Because some of you are working on criminal justice reform here in Pensacola, I hope our story will be of interest and some inspiration to you. So what is restorative justice? Most simply, restorative justice focuses on the rehabilitation of offenders through reconciliation with the victims and the community at large. So it's a process that involves the victims, the offenders, and the community coming together to figure out the best way to repair harm. It emphasizes accountability, making amends, and it transforms lives by repairing the harm caused by crime, often through face-to-face meetings called healing circles. The Center for Justice and Reconciliation says that is an important contemporary expression of timeless standards of justice. This is in reference to the fact that restorative justice has its origins in Native American spirituality and healing circles. Native Americans have used healing circles to address wrongdoing and restore relationships in their communities for probably thousands of years. The restorative justice approach is used in schools in Orleans and Jefferson parishes, here counties, now, with attempts to get it instituted through the State Department of Education in schools throughout Louisiana as an alternative to suspension or juvenile detention and break the school-to-prison pipeline. And although Reverend Julie thinks our work is groundbreaking, which it may be in Orleans Parish and to some extent in Louisiana, the modern version of restorative justice has been used in the criminal justice system in the U.S. and throughout the world since at least the mid-1970s. So I want to tell you about what I have learned about convening a restorative justice healing circle. This is the process. And this can vary, you know, by facilitators or institutions that offer this service. But the group we're working with, this is their process. A facilitator meets with or interviews everyone who will participate in the circle in advance of convening the circle. The facilitator finds out what the victims want or need to see happen in the circle afterwards for their healing. Explains to the offenders that they must accept responsibility for what they did and be willing to repair the harm. The facilitator conducts an assessment of what the individual defendants need in the way of support and assistance when they are let out of jail to enhance their chances of success. For example, mental health care, physical health care, housing, jobs, job training, and so on. And the facilitator invites resource folks to join the circle, including family and community members who have been harmed and who will be involved in supporting the offenders upon their release. And the community may have opinions about what needs to be done to repair harm to the community as well as the victims. A healing circle personalizes the crime. Usually the victims ask why the offenders did what they did and why. They explain how the event harmed them, including longer-term consequences like time lost from work, need to go to and or pay for rehab or therapy of some kind, cost to their families and loved ones, etc. And they tell the offenders what they need to do to repair the harm they caused and commit to never doing this again. The offenders then have the opportunity to admit guilt, say why they did what they did, and have a chance to express remorse. If they do all of this and agree to what the victims want, a restitution agreement is drawn up and presented to the court. And of course, if they're not really willing initially to do all of what the victims want, there is some negotiation that might take place. But the goal is to get to this restitution agreement that can be brought to court at sentencing with the hope that the court will accept the agreement in lieu of prison sentences beyond what the offenders have already served. So healing can happen among all and reminds us that the offenders are part of our community. They're not them, they're not detached entities. They're people and they're part of our community. And we have some responsibility for supporting them when they are released and others before or if they wind up in the criminal justice system. Because I'll tell you, one of the things we met with the district attorney, and the most memorable thing he said in that meeting was that we failed them. We all failed them, talking about the defendants. I was shocked at this admission, but pleased to hear him say that. Okay, getting on to the key players and allies. We're going to put up on the screen. Shay, you might have to shrink the file so the whole thing will appear on the screen, because the last two or three folks aren't on there. This is our who's who. It doesn't have everybody in it, but I wanted to show you some faces of the players who are involved here. Okay, the victims. This is James Curran, and he's a UUA employee who was robbed. He suffered a fractured nose and other milder injuries, and he returned to Boston shortly after the attack and to work soon after that. The other fellow is Tim Byrne. He's another UUA employee. He was robbed and hit in the head and knocked down. He was hospitalized with acute brain injury and other wounds. He was in ICU for at least a week and in the hospital for almost 2 weeks in New Orleans. He needed rehab, but both of the guys have improved greatly, and they've been back at work for some time. Then we have the defendants. If you can scroll, okay. Here we go. Well, the defendants and their defense attorneys. This is Dewan Paul and his attorney, Chris Bonin. Joshua Simmons, 18, his attorney, James Brockway. Nicholas Pogazelski, 18, his attorney, Tanzanika Ruffin. And Rashad Piper, who's 20, and his attorney, Michael Kennedy. You can stop there for a sec. Okay. Three of these four defendants were living at Covenant House, a shelter for runaway and homeless youth on the edge of the French Quarter when the attack happened. Covenant House is a wonderful place. They do really tough work, and they work in the streets of New Orleans to help young people who are... Sadly, the vast majority of the kids they help have experienced years of abuse, violence, and trauma. That seems to have been true for Rashad, who was in foster care most of his life and shuffled all over Louisiana, and he suffers from a serious mental health condition, and maybe some of the others. Dewan is the only one with any observable parental or family support. His mother comes to hearings, joined us to meet with the district attorney, and supposedly has written letters to the victims to apologize for what his son did, for what her son did. She can't send it yet due to court process. All of these four young men were charged with second-degree robbery, which carries mandatory prison sentences. The minimum is 3 years, and the maximum is 30 years. One attorney is trying to get the charges amended to a lower charge for his client, who was probably the least culpable in the whole event. And then we've got the criminal justice system. We don't have pictures of these folks. Key player here is Judge Camille Burris. She's the judge for Section H at Orleans Parish Criminal District Court. She's been on the bench for about 30 years, so she is very entrenched in doing things as they have been done for a long time. But I have to say, she recognizes us when we go in court, because we wear our standing or now on the side of love t-shirts or our Black Lives Matter t-shirts. And she will move the hearing for these guys up on the docket for that day so that she doesn't keep us there all day, particularly if nothing's going to happen, if it's a continuance or, you know, they're waiting to get a competency hearing or something. And then we've got the district attorney, Leon Cannizzaro. Leon's worked in criminal justice his entire adult life. I knew Leon's parents because my son went to their daycare center. So I loved his parents. They were wonderful people. And I went to high school with his wife, and we both are realtors now. So I have lots of connections to them. So I was the one who set up our meetings and so on. And then the assistant district attorneys. There have been three on this case in 11 months. We'll say 10 months by the time they changed to the last one. And Laura Rodrigue, who is an assistant district attorney, who is also the daughter of the district attorney, who did a mediation in a recent past case, and she and her dad compare restorative justice to that, but it wasn't the same. She seems to have interest in doing something alternative, so she, even though she's not in the court with the case, she is an important influencer. And then, of course, we have the defense attorneys, which you saw all of them up there, the four of them. Two have been very receptive to learning about restorative justice from us or through us and considering it. One has been sort of hesitant, and one very negative, and she has not attended any meetings and has not done anything with us. And then we have our allies. Of course, at the UUA, it's Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, our new president last year. She gave an inspiring message at GA, somberly delivering the news of the attack before our Sunday service. She urged us to remember our UU values of universal love and compassion for all people. And she wrote a letter to the DA and judge a bit later advocating for restorative justice. And then there's also Reverend Elizabeth Nguyen. She's the Ministry Associate for Youth and Young Adults of Color at the UUA. She is our main contact and conduit at the UUA to communicate with Tim and James and give input on our strategy. I was going to say something else about her, but I forget. Well, I think I have it somewhere else. But the UUA has been very protective of Tim and James. They've screened all of their cards and letters. As you can imagine, hundreds, if not thousands, have poured in across the country. So they all go to the Human Resources Office at UUA, and UUA kind of goes through it to make sure nothing's in there that would be more traumatizing than the experience itself. And also, that's why she's our main conduit. I've had email with Tim Byrne directly once or twice, but generally we go through Elizabeth so that there's one person sort of carrying things back and forth. But then there are also a couple of UU ministers who gave pastoral care to them when they were in the hospital right after the attack. Reverend Deanna Vandiver, who's the co-director of the Center for Ethical Living and Social Justice Renewal, I'll call CELSJR from now on, and Reverend Darcy Roque, who was living in New Orleans, but she was working for the UUA at the time. She's now the minister of community church. The two of them were the ones mainly involved with giving pastoral care, and Deanna's been involved in a little bit more, which I'll tell you about. I believe the relationships that were forged with the planning committee, UUA staff, CELSJR, and local UUs getting ready and working for GA 2017 made community organizing and restorative justice advocacy move faster and easier for all of us than it would have been otherwise. Then there's the Center for Restorative Approaches. This was founded by Troy Bechet. She's the CEO and founder. As it happens, one of our members, FUNO members, Jolanda Walter, knew Troy and about her work because Jolanda created her website for the center. The Center for Restorative Justice Approaches provides communities with training and tools that build relationships. Relationships are key to all of this. And that allow for those most impacted by conflict and crime to develop their own solutions and ways of repairing harm. The center works largely with schools and facilitates restorative justice circles. Troy offered to facilitate a circle for us, in this case, pro bono, because she's so committed to getting this approach used, not just with young people related to the avoiding suspensions and juvenile detention, but with an adult court. So, and then we have an ally in Virginia Ryan. She works for the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office. She's a justice system administrator. She's working on a grant, and she's been tasked with reducing the prison population. So she's on our side, and she's a good source of intel. And then the circle keeper in Boston, Janet Connors, who's a wonderful person. Scroll down some more. You'll see some of these folks here. That's our minister, Reverend Paul, Jolanda, Reverend Deanna, me, Reverend Melanie, she's been involved, Leslie with our church, Janet Connors, she's the circle keeper in Boston. Janet lost her own son to gun violence about a decade ago and speaks from personal experience as well as training. She offered to do a circle with Tim and James in Boston to help them see what it was like and see if they would be willing to engage in a healing circle with the offenders in New Orleans. So those are the key players. And because we all work full time, we have not had time to, we want to reach out and get more allies to join with us, but we haven't had a chance to do that. And then for me, I had some hesitancy about jumping on the restorative justice bandwagon. I was really upset, angry, grief-stricken when this happened in New Orleans at the first GA being held in New Orleans ever. It was very disturbing for many of us who had invested a lot in that event. Anyway, it took me a while to get past my feelings, but I kept reflecting, and I finally tapped into my long-held UU values and learned more from the people who were working, went to the first bail hearing and so on in our UU community about what was going on with Tim and James and the offenders. Through all of that, you know, I told myself, don't take this personally. And I was able to come back and be a part of this restorative justice ministry. I'm almost out of time, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, like I said, much more to say. But anyway, so I'll just wing it from here. Basically, what has happened since then is that we have met with Troy, and we invited the defense attorneys in to learn about what restorative justice is and what the process is like. In preparation, that was last November, in preparation for a meeting in December with the district attorney. We met with the district attorney in December. It was several of our local UU ministers and some of the members from FUNO, who are the core group doing most of the work, and three defense attorneys, one sub for one of the attorneys, and people from Orleans Parish Prison, Virginia Ryan, and someone who works in the schooling programs there, because two of the guys, one's working on his GED and one's working on his high school diploma. Anyway, and Dewan's mother came as well. So from that meeting, the district attorney basically said that he listened, and he said we failed these young men, and he said that restorative justice or new approaches are coming to criminal justice, which he sees happening over the next 20 years. Well, we don't have 20 years, so he needs to speed up or fast forward, but anyway. So he was agreeable, but what he explained to us was, this is what he said to us. He said that because these young men had no prior convictions, that the district attorney's office would have no role in sentencing. This was totally up to the judge. But we know that everybody in the criminal justice system has known each other a long time, they've worked together for a long time and all that, so I'm sure his opinion influences her. And he said if she wanted to do something like this, she probably would consult with him because she would want his support to the community if she agreed to do this. Bottom line, this is not going to happen. We had our hopes built up that it was going to happen. It was the words restorative justice were actually spoken aloud in court earlier this month at a hearing. When one of the defense attorneys stood up and asked the judge for a continuance because ADA Laura Rodrigue was going to convene a restorative justice circle in the case and they wanted time for that to happen, We were shocked, we were pleased, but guardedly optimistic. Subsequently, I've spoken with her, and she said that's not going to happen, that she and the defense attorneys had a long meeting with the judge. But what's a little bit of good news is that the judge is now saying that she's inclined to give them the mandatory minimum, or perhaps a little more for the ones who are more culpable, when from the beginning she's been talking about giving the mandatory maximums. So that seems to be a little bit of progress. And the victims can submit affidavits at trial, which will be next month. And we can submit testimony at sentencing. So that's kind of where we are and where things are going. And we know that this needs a lot more to be done, but we feel like we're making inroads, but and we are going to keep going regardless of how things turn out.